the classic one that they might give you. It can be confused with PCP, which we'll get to in a second in terms of the way it appears. And like I said, Legionella is anything but atypical. Look at it. It gives you big, classic, lobar infiltrates, just like a pneumococcus or an H flu. Okay? And it's bad. Okay? The differential in a bad pneumonia like Legionella is all the other typicals and staph, and I would cover them for all of those. Okay. Now, here we're getting into things that I know that no matter how good you are and how seasoned you are, you don't see these things, and therefore, they're going to test you on them. Okay? Because, and there are things that we should know, because they're really bad things, okay? And so what I've done there is I've tried to put the key things about fungi, and that will usually, the giveaway there will be where they're from in the state, okay? Q fever and psittacosis are both bad life-threatening pneumonias. The tip-off will be what they do. You know, they're handling big animals, you're thinking Q fever. They're handling birds, you think psittacosis. And both of them have a few other features there to help you nail it down. Memorize those charts, guys. So here's a fungal pneumonia, which is sort of bilateral patchy infiltrates. You would never be able to tell what this is by just looking at the x-ray, but then once they tell you that the guy comes from the San Joaquin Valley, or they tell you that the guy comes from the Ohio Valley, right, then you're cluing into this diagnosis of fungi. Now, this slide is better on the screen. It's the only one so far that's better on the screen than in your handouts because it's color-coded, okay? And so that's how I want you to memorize it. Now, at ABEM General Hospital, I don't know if any of you ever worked there in Chicago, they're very geeky, and unlike you, they go and do a gram stain on the sputum of all their patients. You all know that that's a complete waste of time, right, because you get all kinds of crap there, and it's never helpful, and I don't recommend it. But on exams, it makes for easy questions, okay? So here's the thing to memorize, the gram positives on the top, the negatives in the middle, and the ones you can't even see at the bottom. We've already covered those, okay? But I want to point out a couple of things about this that I think are really specific possibilities for the exams. And one of them is anthrax. It's a dead giveaway. There are not many things that cause gram-positive rods. So when you see a gram stain with gram-positive rods, especially in the climate of paranoia that we're in this country, think anthrax, okay? Now, the other thing I'd point out to you is Yersinia pestis. That's sometimes gram stain as well, negative rods, but that's not as specific because there's lots of other things that they would think of before they get to Yersinia pestis. You know, we had a case about a year ago now in our minor area. The residents incised an abscess, okay, and I'm on duty, and a call comes in from the lab saying, yeah, we got we have this little, like, stat hotline for troponins and stuff like that. Yeah, we got a Yersinia pestis here. I'm going, oh, yeah, you do. And I'm sort of, like, thinking about, like, packing up my bags and heading for, because remember, the Yersinia pestis is very transmissible, so I'm thinking of sort of exit routes, you know, Hollywood Hills, then to the Santa Monica Mountains, and maybe, you know, through the pass and Simi Valley, you know, back to Canada, right, where we don't have stuff like that. So it turned out that they incised a bubo, and we do have, it is endemic in the L.A. County area, we do have areas where there's, you know, there's woods, there's mountains, there's these rodents that have these fleas that actually bite people that are homeless or that are up there doing whatever the heck he was doing up there, and he got the plague. So that kind of sucks. Now, that's different than the plague that you get from bioterrorism, where they aerosolize it and it goes straight into your lungs. And I have a slide or two on that coming up. So that's important to know. So I want to point those out. Now, if you see something intracellular, okay, think chlamydia. That's also something I would circle. So those are easy questions to get because you see the slide and you see that's the only thing that can cause it. And then no bacteria we've already covered. If there's PMNs, think Legionella. If there's only mononuclear cells, think mycoplasma. So there's an example. I know this is a shock to the system for a lot of you. That's a gram stain, okay? I know. I'm equally ignorant about these things. In fact, every time I give this lecture, I'm so paranoid that I'm going to confuse what color gram-positive and gram-negative is and make the biggest ass in the world out of myself. So anyway, gram-positive are there, and they're kind of like a purplish-blue, okay? And they're in pairs, so that's a diplococci. So know those. Know that. Memorize that table. Okay. Now, pneumonia treatment, all right? I have simplified. Last year's course had about 15 slides on this. I've broken it down to one table, okay? And it's real straightforward, okay? You treat these with macrolides, okay, or doxy. And if they're over 60, then you've got to think a little more about some of those bad gram-negatives, like E. coli and Klebsiella and Enterobacter and H. flu. And in that case, It's not good enough just to use a macrolide. You got to get better gram-negative coverage. And so then you've got to either add a cephalosporin or use a fluoroquinolone. Okay, so that's all really straightforward. If they're impatient, because they look sick, same thing, okay? But this last segment is very important to know, okay? There are two things that you can consider adding to the sick patients, the sickest ones, okay? One is an anti-pseudomonal cephalosporin, like ceftazidime, for example, or an aminoglycoside, and that's to cover the pseudomonas. So for the sick diabetic or the hospitalized patient or the cystic fibrosis patient, that type of thing, right? And number two, you want to think about adding vanco. And I want you to be clear on the two reasons why we might use vanco. Number one, there's a lot of Staph aureus out there in the bad pneumonias, and MRSA, as you know, is an epidemic. So that's the first reason. But the second reason, I think a lot of people don't know this, is that now that we're misusing antibiotics to the extent we are, that a lot of plain ordinary strep pneumo is now also resistant to the cephalosporins. So the vanco is also for that. So it's for staph, for MRSA, and for the bad strep, and for the strep pneumos in the sick patient. Now, here's another chart, okay? Again, a high yield chart on kids. Okay, now kids in their neonatal period have the exact same organisms as they get for meningitis, okay? Those three there. Now, in this chart, I put the first bold one as the most common. If they ask you the most common cause, you can use that bold one at the top. Now, the treatment is ampinjet, okay, or you can use cefotaxime. I want you to remember, you cannot use ceftriaxone, which I also call emergicillin. You cannot use ceftriaxone in the first month because it causes kernicterus, because its protein bound displaces the bilirubin and causes the brain damage, okay? So that's one thing I wanted to point out to you. Now, strep pneumo then becomes the most prevalent, and you can use erythro or cephalosporin if they're sicker. And then the next thing that I want to emphasize is that viruses then become the most predominant thing. So once they're out of that three-month age group where we're most worried about kids, right, that are febrile and stuff, viruses take over, and you don't necessarily need to use antibiotics unless you really think it's bacterial. Then mycoplasma takes over, as you know, for the young kids and the pre-adolescents. Again, you can use macrolides for that, as we've discussed. And in all ages, just like in adults, you must add vanco in the sickest patients for the two reasons that we mentioned. Now, we've already covered a lot of what's on this slide, but these things are rare. None of us can pretend to be experts in them, and they come up on exams all the time because they're life-threatening and they're important. We're part of the surveillance networks here, okay? So hantavirus, think New Mexico. Think of that picture on the left of Santa Fe. That's how I remember it. And it's all the feces from all these field mice that give it to you. And what it is, hantavirus in a nutshell, is you completely destroy your lungs and need ECMO, and you go into shock and hemorrhage. It's a nightmare, okay? But obviously it's an important thing for us to pick up. No specific therapy, okay, just supportive. Now on to plague and anthrax. They're very different in the fact that plague, when you get a case of pulmonary plague, is very contagious. Remember I told you, I'm heading for the hills. Plague, I'm heading for Canada, okay? And in plague, you transmit it to one another, okay? It's very bad in the lungs, and the other kind of it, the bubo part, doesn't usually go to the lungs until after. So the bioterrorism part is pulmonary usually, and the part you get from the flea bite is more often the bubo form, which doesn't necessarily get contagious until it spreads to the lungs later on if you don't treat it. Now, anthrax is different. When it's used as a bioterror agent, it's also aerosolized, but because it's a spore disease, it's not transmissible to other people. Okay? Big difference there. It is classic for causing this hemorrhagic mediastinitis. So when you see the ratty outline of the mediastinum, the ratty outline, that's when you think anthrax. You might also get it on the Gram stain. And this is another point I want to make about the treatment for these two. Hantavirus doesn't have a treatment, but for plague and anthrax, the treatment includes doxy. You'll see I put that in bold. Let me just step back and digress for a second and tell you something that I found very helpful in my life. You guys all know Billy Mallon? He was in my job before me. He was a residency director at County General before me. He did a little sabbatical, and he went down and took the tropical medicine course down at Gorgas, this great course that I've been wanting to take for a long time. And I said, Billy, what'd you learn? And he said, I'll tell you what I learned, Stuart. Very confusing. But one thing I'll tell you is nobody dies in the tropics without a dose of doxy. That's what he learned. And it's a very important point, because whenever you have some funky infectious thing that they give you, someone was traveling, or some funky constellation of symptoms, it looks like some infectious disease that you can't really figure it out, okay, you look down the answers, and you look for the doxy, and you circle it. All right? You got it? Same thing goes for bioterror. If some funky, crazy cult releases some funky, crazy stuff, doxing. Okay? That ought to do you solid for a question or two. Okay, now, do we got some Canadians here? Where are the Canadians? Admit it. Holy smokes. You guys are a threat to Homeland Security. Now, you guys might know about SARS because you might have seen some cases. I know a lot of my friends in Canada have seen this, and it's pretty scary stuff. What do you need to know about SARS? One, patients that have respiratory complaints should not come into emergency departments. That's the first thing. Okay? But you're laughing, but I'm serious, okay? They should not come in, right? We keep letting our guard down, okay? And now the Canadians are letting their guard down again, and we're going to have another big nightmare with this, okay? Patients with respiratory complaints should be screened at the front and should be masked at the very least, and if there's any concern about travel or funkiness, they should go into the isolation booth, okay? It's person to person, it's really contagious, it's a coronavirus, and it is from the feces of the civet cat, which they like to eat in Guangdong province. Okay, in China. So that's all you need to know. I told you about 18 words, and those are the only 18 that anyone knows. So that's how you do it. It's only symptomatic therapy. There's no specific therapy. Okay, let's take a little... Okay, where are we at? Slide 53. We're doing wonderful for time, okay? And I'm going to take a little stretch, and I want to encourage you to all take a little stretch, because this is pretty freaking brutal, isn't it? Ah, yes. Very good. Let's walk around. I'm still in the box, by the way. Notice I'm still in the box. Not moving. Okay. Very good. Prevent DVT. We're going to get to that in a minute. Yeah, we're more than halfway through, and we're on time. Okay. Now, don't all leave. Believe me. It's all here. All the stuff on the test. It's got to be here. Okay. Now, we're going to talk about AIDS, okay? Now, this is a bit of a busy slide, but what is the important point here? The important point is, what's the most common infection in the chest in an AIDS patient? The same as a non-AIDS patient. That's the first important point. They die of the same pneumonias that the rest of us do, okay? Now, the second point on that chart that's important is that not everything in the chest in an AIDS patient is pneumonia. Okay, they get Kaposi sarcoma, they get lymphomas, they get other stuff. And the Kaposi sarcomas are all nasty because they bleed and they cause hemoptysis sometimes. So just remember, step back a second and it could be non-infectious. Now, this is the money slide made by me for you, okay, to tell you everything that you need to know about infections in AIDS and HIV. Okay, the first thing you'll notice, just a couple of general comments, is that community-acquired pneumonia, as we've mentioned, appears in all three categories. The next thing you'll notice is that tuberculosis appears in all three categories. And that's because, ladies and gentlemen, it don't matter what your CD4 count is. TB is a risk from the moment you convert positive to HIV. It has nothing to do with your CD4 count. You can get it at any time. You're more likely to die when you're lower, and it's more fulminant later, but TB is a risk at any stage. Okay? We're going to talk a little more detail about PCP in a moment. And that's something that we're expected to know well. And for those of you that don't see a lot of this, I'm going to tell you the details that you need to know. And then as you move lower down on your, and that's under 200, that's a big thing there. And then as you move lower down on your chart here, you'll see that there's a whole bunch of other nastiness here. And those things are pre-terminal, okay? Once the CMV is in the equation, or the mycobacteriumavium complex, or the fungi, it's the end, okay? Those are terminal things. And then the Kaposi's too. Okay, so PCP is something that we're expected to know a little bit about. And so I'll tell you what you need to know about it. Number one, it can look like anything. It could be the guy saying, I got chest pain. It can be the guy saying that I have shortness of breath. It could be the guy saying I feel weak. It can be any of those things. Okay, it's a clinical diagnosis, and there's no way to make it definitively except by doing a washing and actually putting a special silver stain. You're never going to do that in ER, so it's a clinical diagnosis. But one thing you're expected to know is the importance of LDH. LDH is sensitive, but not specific. So if the LDH is not elevated, it's not PCP, okay? It's not. But if it is elevated, it still could be other things, like LDH goes up in TB. So that's an important test that you need to know. That's helpful. And remember, you need to consider this in even patients that don't know they have AIDS, right? A huge percentage of our patients that present with AIDS don't know it. And don't forget that. And so on the exams, when they tell you, they don't tell you the patient has AIDS, you remember that, what I said. And the people writing questions know that too. And you know that too in practice, so don't forget it. Yes, sir. the question at the front is, are we talking a little bit of elevation here or massive elevation? Usually the LDH is up 2 to 3 times, okay, but if it's completely normal by your lab, that makes PCP very unlikely, and on the test situation, I would eliminate it, okay? It's very sensitive. Now, the next thing I want you to know is about the drugs that we use to treat it. Now, drugs, for people doing tests, and from a, like a global health perspective, and from a, you know, a sort of like a big picture perspective, you should concentrate on drugs when you're studying. Because remember primum non nocere, right? First do no harm. We're expected in every specialty to know a lot about the drugs that we do because, for goodness sake, you should at least know the harm that you're causing yourself. Okay? And so that's really true. And I found that that is a philosophy in general of people in education. So when we're talking about the treatments, I want you to know all the things that are nasty about them. First of all, Bactrim's a first-line treatment for PCP pneumonia, right? Bactrim's a first-line treatment, and we give prophylaxis to people with CD4 counts once they drop below 200. Okay, now, the problem is that AIDS patients develop allergies at way higher rates to that. So allergy is the key thing you need to remember. Number two, it causes, especially when you give it IV, dangerous drops in their white count. And that ain't good, right? When your ANC goes down, you've already got AIDS. So those are the two things about Bactrim. Two, pentamidine. What do you need to know? I'll tell you what you need to know. You give it IV, and it causes hypotension and hypoglycemia. Memorize that, okay? Three, Dapsone. That's our third-line agent, okay? You already remember Dapsone because we mentioned it when we talked about MET hemoglobinemia. We had that on the first slide, okay? That's the thing to remember there. Now, steroids, they don't seem like something that would be good in a patient who's immunocompromised. Now, do they? But in fact, in both PCP and, interestingly, folks, in TB meningitis, which is another thing that sometimes AIDS patients get, steroids are indicated. So steroids are given to hypoxic patients with PCP. Moving along, new topic, foreign body aspiration. You need to know this. Now, foreign body aspiration is something that's missed, and it causes big-time lawsuits and big-time morbidity, okay? And I've actually put a little bit about this in the box for you to remember. The reason why we miss this a lot is because it's not always a classic presentation where Johnny all of a sudden was choking. I mean, that's easy. It's not often like that. And all too often, they respond to our empiric therapy with, you know, beta agonist or oxygen. They look like pneumonias on the chest x-ray, so we miss them. Every time you find yourself making a diagnosis of asthma, pneumonia, bronchiolitis, croup, that kind of thing, if it's a little bit out of what you normally see in terms of the story, consider this diagnosis. Get it followed up. It's a good piece of advice for someone who's seen a lot of these claims. Now, in adults, you just think about people that, for whatever reason, are childlike because of mental retardation or psychiatric illnesses, or they have other issues that make them at risk for aspiration. Now, there's a lot of anxiety about these x-rays and a lot of confusion I've found, okay? So I decided to take an actual case and lead you through what to look for on the x-rays, okay? Now, here's a kid who had a classic story, so there's no issue about missing it in terms of the story here. So we knew what we were looking for. We were looking for a peanut in the right mainstem bronchus or something like that, right? And by the way, that's a common thing. Right mainstem peanut is probably the most common thing. But those don't show up on x-rays, right? The peanuts are not radiolucent, except for the ones that they serve on Southwest. I don't know if you've had those, but they're a little bit toxic. So what are you looking for, right? You're looking for asymmetry. So here's a PA in a lateral. What does it show? Nothing. You don't see anything radiolucent. You're no further along. You're looking, right? So what do you do next? This is what you do next. Number one, don't forget about the neck. So take a lateral soft tissue neck of these people and look for something up there, okay? That's the next step. What else do you do? You do an expiratory film. Now, that's easier said than done. A 7-month-old expiratory film? There's this guy up in Canada, in the north of Canada, where I started when I first started practice, and he invented a machine that was like, it was called a pigostat. I think it was Dr. Pig, P-I-G-G. It was called a pigostat. And you'd stick the kid in it, okay? And it was like, he was like that. He couldn't move, right? And then it had a little, honest to God, it had like a little timing device. So what happens when you stick a kid in that? Like, and it actually would time to their expiratory, it would time to their expiration the exposure, and it would give you an expiratory film. But unless you have such a mechanism, you probably aren't getting a lot of expiratory films. But it turns out on exams, they have no problem getting them, right? What are you looking for? What are you looking for on an expiratory film? When you try to force air out of the lungs, you're looking for one not to deflate. And that's the one that's involved with the mainstem foreign body, right? So in this case, what do you see? Nothing. They both look the same. I'm no further along. So what do I do next? Well, I want this kid to get bronched, right? I want the guy, it's 3 in the morning, and I want the guy to come in. Okay, now at the end of the day, with this story, the right answer is always, even if I see nothing on the x-rays, I've got a story, I'm worried, and I'm waking that guy up at 3 in the morning regardless. But, you know, I'm like you, and you guys know real life, right? We kind of want to say, hey, listen, I've got it, I'm showing it on the x-ray, I can document it. It makes you feel better about, you know, engaging all those people and waking them up in the middle of the night, right? And so what do you do next? D-cube. That's the best way to get this. Because it's not dependent on their respiratory phase, okay? And so here's the deal. So this reproduces like crap, but look at your handout, okay? So this kid is now lying down on both sides, and here's his right to cube. What do you see? Right? You see that the right side looks the same as the left side. But if you lie the kid on their side, the right side should deflate with gravity. But it doesn't. So D-cube is the best way, the most sensitive way on plain film to document, in this case, the right main stem with a peanut in it. Okay? So there is the sequence of equations. Hopefully that'll help you sort that out. Okay. This slide sucks, right? Because it's just got a bunch of text on it. So let me point out what's important. First off, all the same issues that go with foreign body aspiration in an adult are the ones that go with aspiration pneumonia, right? The same people are at risk. Alcoholics, edentulous, all that kind of stuff, right? And everything under severity, I think you already know. Obviously, if there's, you know, peas and carrots in their trachea, that's worse than if there's no peas and carrots. So those things are kind of straightforward. You might not have known that if the pH is low, it's bad. So if you put these people on PPIs, that reduces the damage that's done. So that's one thing in terms of when they do aspirate. Now, in terms of clinical features, this is interesting. And there's one important point that you might not know about this I want to point out. Now, you probably know that sometimes they look terrible clinically after they aspirate, and the chest x-ray shows what? Squat, right? And sometimes it's the exact opposite. Sometimes the chest x-ray looks like crap, and they look fine, and they haven't yet, you know, started to show the manifestation of all the acid in their lungs. But here's one important point for you, and this is something you're expected to know. You do not start antibiotics on these people until they spike a fever. And there's good data to show that, right? The ICU literature shows that when you start Clinda empirically, you select out all the organisms that are really bad, and they have a worse outcome. So that's an important pearl for you. Okay, now, in last year's course, and I'm going to have to, I don't know how this is on your handout. It's really crappy here, but we'll try to deal with that. I summarized about 15 slides worth of TB from last year's course onto one slide here. And it's pretty much most of what you need to know about TB. I'm going to try to use the pointer here. Now, in this picture here, there's mom who's generously donating a batch of red snappers to her daughter. Okay? She's got a little nidus there in her lungs, and she's snappifying her daughter. Now, then we all, once we're exposed, okay, so this is, for example, in our emergency department, it's a big problem. We've got a lot of TB people. What happens is that you get a little settling in the lower zone. So initially it goes into lower zones. It's a gome complex. And then it disseminates all around the body and settles in the lymph nodes. And then it goes. Then you don't hear anything more from it. And the only thing that you can know to see that they're positive at that point is a skin test. Okay? Now then from there, okay, most people just go into a latent period. And for years and years and years, they don't hear anything until maybe they get cancer one day or they're down and out one day and they become homeless. They go to prison. All these things that are risk factors, and then the TB comes out. Actually, the prison part really, that's different because they're getting infected in prison. But basically, when they become immunocompromised, it comes out. And then you have what's called reactivation tuberculosis, and that is what classically happens in the upper zones where the oxygen tension is highest. Okay? Now, if you are either having A, bad luck, because some people do go straight into post-primary TB, or if you've got AIDS or you're immunocompromised, you don't actually have this latent phase often. You go straight to having fulminant pulmonary TB. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is more frequently in the lower zones. And that causes a lot of confusion. So these people can have big lower zone pneumonias and pleural effusions and all that kind of stuff. And sometimes that's why it gets missed. People are like, oh, that's not TB because it's lower zones. That's the classic post-primary or immediate manifestations of infection. They go straight into this, okay? And so that's important for you to know. I will tell you a couple of other things about TB that I think are important. For most of us that are immunocompetent, TB is either pulmonary or non-pulmonary, extrapulmonary. About 3/4 of the time, it's pulmonary. Okay? The rest of the time, it's in all the exciting places, the adrenals, the uterus, right? All those interesting, exciting TV things. Scrofula, right, in the neck. The two do not intersect, okay? If you have a patient that comes in with adrenal TV or they have scrofula in their neck, actually, they're not infectious. They're not having pulmonary red snappers, okay? That all goes out the window in AIDS. In AIDS, it's real different. In AIDS, they coexist. A lot of patients have both pulmonary and non-pulmonary at the same time. And to make matters more confusing, in AIDS, sometimes you don't get much on your chest x-ray. If you're immunocompetent and your chest x-ray is negative, and a lot of you guys are probably converters, you can still work, right? You're not infectious. But if you've got AIDS, all bets are off. And so they could have an extra pulmonary manifestation like scrofula or adrenal TB or in their uterus TB and in their bones TB, and at the same time, even with a negative chest x-ray, be infectious. So hopefully that will help you to sort out those questions about isolation and all that kind of stuff. So here's some pictures, okay? Here's a classic cavitating lesion in the upper zones. It could be staph, right? Remember necrotizing, okay? But we're going to think because it's upper zone, it's probably going to be TB is what they're getting at, okay? Here's a patient with Miller ATB, and this is really hard to show, except if you're looking at the x-ray yourself, right, because it's those tiny little millet seeds. And I want to be clear on something. Miller ATB is not pulmonary TB. Miller ATB is total body TB. It's like total body dolor, okay? It's total body TB, and so they're getting it. I'm going to isolate them, of course, but it's really a hematogenous. It's not necessarily just pulmonary. AFB smears, what do we know about them? They are insensitive. So if you've got a person that you think has TB, it don't matter if they've got negative AFB. You still have to isolate them, okay? Because it's only about 60% sensitive. So don't forget that. And that's what the little red snappers look like. Okay, they might show you that. Now, I'm not going to go through this slide in details, but the things I said earlier are very germane. You need to know the side effects of these drugs. So please memorize this slide. Now, as you probably know, a PPD is not negative or positive, is it? Okay? It's a relative thing. It depends on who the host is. So if you have a patient who's, you know, totally normal kid, you know, no contacts, you know, they come in for, like, a screening test at school, anything less than 15 millimeters is not considered positive. You want them to have a robust reaction to call them positive. This is a CDC slide, straight from the CDC. If it's you or me, and we're not HIV positive, but we work in the hospital, 10 millimeters will suffice for a positive reaction. If it's a patient with immunocompromised, like severe COPD or AIDS or a sickly patient for other reasons, 5 millimeters will do. Sarcoidosis is not an emergency medicine disease, but it's relatively common. It's something that does wind its way into our emergency departments, so I'm going to tell you a few things about it that might be helpful for an exam purpose, okay? It's non-infectious, as you know. It does cause the classic bihilar adenopathy. So this might even be confused with PCP pneumonia or mycoplasma, like we've discussed. These patients have eye symptoms. They have specific skin lesions. They'll give you enough on a test question so you'll know what they're talking about. There's no specific magic bullet treatment other than steroids when they get exacerbations of their skin problems, their eye problems, or their lung problems. They get, of course, the steroids, generally speaking. And I touch base with someone who knows more about it than I do. And I know that where I park at the hospital, that there's this dude that parks next to me, and his license plate says sarcoid. So there's a dude that knows more about it than I do. Okay, now, mediastinal masses. Very narrow spectrum of things that I think can be asked about this. Let's nail this puppy down, okay? Remember, it's the T's, okay? Thymoma, ectopic thyroid, they might give you other clues here, teratoma with teeth and hair, T-cell lymphoma, and the terrible carcinoma. Now, if you've got a 20-year-old kid, it's lymphoma. If you've got a 60-year-old man, it's bronchogenic carcinoma. That's how it breaks down, okay? What might an x-ray look like of this? This is the one I think I would use if I was an examiner. Okay, normally behind the sternum, in between the right ventricle and the sternum, there should be a lot of space there. In this case, there's a lot of something there, and that something could be one of those terrible teats. Okay, that's all I think we need to know about that. SVC syndrome, real important for ER doctors. So what do we need to know about that one? Well, you've seen these patients maybe before. If you haven't, headache is a real prominent complaint. You think headache, And then you look at the patient, you see they're engorged, they have maybe petechiae in their conjunctiva, they're bluish looking, and the blood is trying any way it can to get back to the heart because the SVC is blocked, so it's going to try to find its way around on the chest wall if it can, okay? SVC obstruction, these guys get admitted, they're sick patients, it's taken very seriously, I put them in a monitored setting. How do I fix it? Two things. In 2007, interventional radiology is usually the way to go. They can stent past this thing. The other thing to keep in mind is emergency radiotherapy and sometimes chemotherapy. Okay? That's all you got to know about SVC syndrome. Okay, now, spontaneous pneumothorax. The causes? Okay, lots of causes.